So, we did some work back in the 90s looking at auto manipulations and what is best and what works, etc. And we looked at what does mowing do, and we had a control where we didn't do anything. And what does basically disking and tilling do? He saw the disc and he saw the little tiller. And so the bottom line is with respect to, we're in late succession here. This is, again, this is swamp smartweed. This is one of your species, Polygonum hydropiperoides. John made a good point, and he said, you know, in over in Nebraska and also in the Midwest, you will hear a lot of folks talk about managing for smartweed. Smartweed is good. Smartweed is great. And that is a different type of species. There's a Lepathifolium, which is also one of your species, and a Pennsylvanicum. So Polygonum, Pennsylvanicum, and Lepathifolium. Pink smartweed and Pennsylvania, I don't know what the common names are, but whatever they are. Now they tend to produce more seed than Hydropiperoides, which is swamp smartweed. But I'll tell you what, smartweed, regardless, does not produce as much seed as what you have here, which are annual grasses and sedges. Your Panicums, your Echinochloas, your Cyperus, those are producing a hell of a lot more seed than smartweed could be capable of producing. All right, and there's good invertebrate production. So mowing, if you're going to go in and mow, it's not going to change succession. Write that down. It will not change succession. Now, that's important because you still may use mowing. All right, and we'll talk about when you may use mowing. It definitely isn't to set back succession. What you want to do is you want to go in and you want to disc an area if you want to set back succession in the fall. And what we show is that there was an increase in vegetative biomass. Look at between here and here. Why? Because you have all of these annual plants. They are fast growing species, lots of leaf matter coming in here, dominating after you break that soil. You have an increase in species richness and diversity, and you have an increase in seed yield. All the good things, all right? High seed production, lots of food, and a diverse food base. This is going in the fall, like in October, and looking at the following October, all right? So this is a year later. And you have this nice annual community. This is the edge of the plot right here, and here you can see we're in late succession. And there's just, a mowed or a controlled plot. They look the same. Mowing didn't do anything. Now, mowing can be beneficial. I don't know if I have it here. Yeah, mowing is good in autumn if you're already in early succession. So one problem here with being in early succession and having... Look how thick that is. If you flood it up, it will take several months for that vegetation to topple over. Okay, remember it is non-persistent, so it is going to topple. But in the meantime, your seed resources, etc., they're decomposing. You want those birds in there eating stuff. All right. So mowing is good if you're in early succession and you have a very dense stand of early successional vegetation. You go in there, you know it's not going to change the successional state, but it is cheaper to run a mower through a bush hog through than it is a disc, all right? So you can go in there and you can just mow some open patches. Not everything, you don't want to mow the whole damn thing down. You just want to go in and mow some spots so when it floods up, they are open. They're landing platforms and then the birds will work into the vegetation and help with knocking that vegetation down, okay? So that is when mowing is good. I hope this is creating a suite of understanding with respect to managing for waterfowl, because again, this will be important for you professionally, but all of these things that you, these notes that you're taking and information that you're getting, you want to hold on to it, because next spring when you're doing your management plans and you have a wetland area, you're going to need to make some decisions here. And use this information to make those decisions. And we'll give you more practice in that before we're all over with today. So how do you want to go in and do these manipulations? As I mentioned, you don't want to go in and just disc the whole damn area unless that's, you just have to. I mean, sometimes it comes down to practical things that it's definitely cheaper to go in and just disc the whole thing one time than to go in one year and disc half of it and then disc the other half the next year. But that's the ideal scenario. You need to set back succession, right? The ideal scenario is basically 50-50. And I'll tell you the ideal scenario, it is based on what is called the Hemi-Marsh concept. The Hemi-Marsh concept is a concept in wetland ecology which is based on empirical scientific evidence that shows you have the greatest water bird use when you have approximately an equal interspersion of emergent vegetation and water. This is just a diagram illustrating that. So Milton Weller, who is was an eminent waterfowl ecologist in the 70s, did some research and demonstrated that the greatest abundance and richness of water birds are attracted when you have a Hemi-Marsh, a 50-50 type ratio of open water and vegetation. Rick Kaminsky, who you all will know for his PhD work, looked at what might be some of the reasons driving this. Well, he did it on the breeding grounds, and they found actually aquatic invertebrate production was greatest in cattail marshes that had a 50-50 configuration. Now, this was replicated on the wintering grounds by Lauren Smith, and they again found the greatest abundance and richness of birds in a Hemi-Marsh type scenario. This might be a lot of different things, but that's the trend. That's the trend. Now, in reality, what we're talking about doing is going into an area, and this is the ideal scenario, where you create, brown is unmanipulated, green is manipulated. So you're going in the fall, maybe opening up an area, and you're creating nice little patches here, okay, different shape. And this is ideal. I realize this may not be realistic because of time constraints and money and things like that. But the closer you come to this ideal scenario, the better. Where you have vegetation interspersed with these open areas where birds land, they will acquire food resources in these open areas and they will begin to work into these vegetation areas and knock it down. These also depend on how persistent that vegetation, these can work as hunting zones if they're spaced out a good amount of distance. So you can have them as hunting zones. Now, all right, so that is, again, what are you doing in the fall? You're either doing one of two things, all right? You're either going to go in and disc to set back succession, or you're going to go in and you're going to mow if you need to. The vegetation is so dense, but you're just going to mow when you're basically in early succession or mid-succession. You don't need to set it back. And I guess probably if you can't do something like that, then at least try to do it in some fashion where, okay, let's do half of my impoundment. And you have your impoundment here, okay? If you're gonna do half, don't do this, all right? Don't just go and manipulate that. If you can, do it, even if it has to be blocky, do it in something like this type of regard, where you go and you manipulate here and you manipulate here. That is, you can still do that cheap, but you still have two things. You're manipulating just half of your wetland. So what you end up doing here is you have two different states of succession. So you're going in and you're disking these areas, and this will be a year behind. It'll be in a different state of succession with different plant communities, increasing that nutritional diversity. All right. And if you are just going to, if you're just going to go and mow to open up areas, what I would recommend is get one of your workers, give them a bottle of Jack Daniels, get them liquored up, and have them just drive all through here, okay? Yeah, all right, woohoo! Okay, excellent, that's great. Just create some open areas if you're not having any hunting or whatever. And the more just kind of natural it is, the better. All right.
Can we use this as a defense whenever they come out there and they shoot on the track with a bottle of wild turkey?
Yeah, I don't care. Whatever. That's right. That's right. Yeah, so, all right. But you get the point. You get the point. And that is, you know, if you can create some sinuous strips through here, you know, heck, that's just dynamite. Okay? So, now you want to make them, you know, you may want to have some areas that open up a little bit larger than others, like so, like that, you know, but at any rate. Now, the problem with doing this with a disc, like you're setting back succession, is to try to follow this on the outside the next year. So, you know, by breaking your units into quadrants, you know, and maybe do it half 1 year, or you could have it on a four-year rotation, you know, where you're doing quarters. But I would say half and half is probably the best. Keep them close with respect to your successional stages, and then do something a little bit crazy when it comes to opening up if you need to in the fall. All right? Okay. Wild turkey, is that distilled in Tennessee?
No, it's
in Philly, Kentucky. See, that's why I said Jack Daniels.
Yeah, but I'm 101%.
Okay. Fair enough. That's a good response. Okay. Now, what about natural manipulations? Burning. That's been drilled into your head. It's burn. Well, again, burning in wetlands generally is not very effective at setting back succession. All right. It's often used where either, number one, the vegetation is so dense that you can't really even drive a tractor through. Or it's just your disc is not very effective, so you may burn off some of that vegetation so you can go and break the soil. It's also used a lot in coastal areas where you'll never be able to get a disc in there. So they'll even burn across the water. Like in the winter, for example, in Louisiana, in Louisiana, they will burn many of their coastal marshes in November. Everything is senesced and it's dry. Those stalks are sticking above the water and they are dry as can be, and they can carry a fire right over the water. And there's been a lot of research that's been done looking at actually that specific management practice in coastal wetlands. We all know you burn plants. And you're releasing carbon, nutrients, etc., into the soil, increasing fertility of that soil. Some of the research they did in Louisiana actually showed that the vegetation that responded had higher nutritive quality than the vegetation prior to the burn. Okay, so the plants are taking up those nutrients, and there's higher nutrition. Now, why is that important? In particular, they were looking at these shoots being produced and actually providing goose habitat. Geese are grazers. They're flying cows, okay? And so what you want to provide for them is cow habitat, all right? Things that they can graze. So they're not going after, seeds and inverts for the most part. They're eating grass. All right. They also showed that burning increased plant diversity and increased aquatic invertebrate biomass. This is a big one. Again, you release those nutrients, you flood it up, and you will have good aquatic invertebrate response. So, now, plant diversity, you might look at that and say, well, isn't that setting back succession? Yeah, show a marginal trend. But I'm telling you, to be effective in most systems, you really need to break that soil if you can. Now, the other thing is that depending on your area, it just may not be practical to go and disc. You're going to have to maybe just focus on a couple areas with the dollars that you have or what have you, you know, just with the personnel you have, etc. So you might use burning more often, and burning's better than nothing. It will definitely, you know, you can keep woody plants from establishing pretty well by burning. All right. The other thing you can do is if you're getting woody encroachment and you don't have a disc, you can cut those plants off with a bush hog, and you can flood up those areas. You can overtop the shoots, and you can actually kill the woody plants. So never let woody plants get established so you have to take a damn chainsaw in there, or you've lost the battle. Always keep on top of it. And you can use hydrology as one of those things. I'll tell you what, there aren't many plants out there that you cannot kill with water. All right? There are some plants, but even invasive plants. The bottom line is, hydrophytes, if you get in there, you want to do something, you want to set back succession, go in there, bush hog everything, burn everything. Bush hogging is best. You get let things grow some, you bush hog it, the plants are going, they're respiring, they're trying to stay alive, and then pump water on top of it, a foot over top of it, you'll kill it. You'll kill anything, all right? 2 feet would be even better. So you want to put water over top of it and you can kill it. That's a good way, in many cases, to take care of invasive species. Now, there are invasive species, like alligator weed, where all you do is just piss it off, all right? And it can have an aquatic form, it can have an emergent form, and so in those cases, you have to use herbicides. We'll talk about herbicides in a second. All right, so generally, again, my recommendation is to use burning in concert with disking when you are setting back succession, if you want to run a fire. Again, the problem with fires is, again, you need to do it safe, and there's always a risk when you start that drip torch. All right, now, what about grazing? Well, there has been research done on grazing, and cattle can be very effective at, again, influencing the structure. Again, if you have a very dense stand of vegetation that comes up through the growing season, if you have some type of sharecropping agreement where you can actually have cattle come in for a short period of time, you can rotate those animals in and let them reduce the vegetation biomass. They're acting like little mowers for you, okay? Except they're doing it in a much more natural mosaic than a bush hog does, all right? And when you flood it up, you'll have nice patches of emergent standing vegetation and other areas that were grazed down low, and that's great. Now, you don't see that type of sharecropping or whatever agreement, landowner agreement with state game areas or refuges very much in the States. This was down in Puerto Rico. They did have that type of arrangement. They are good for influencing the structure. They also are crapping while they're out there. Okay? And they're creating detritus by knocking things down, blah, blah, blah. So when it's flooded up, you usually have pretty good aquatic invertebrate responses. Yeah. If you needed to, yeah, but certainly you don't want to overgraze.
And then you can also try possibly with root vest, if you had some both animals in there that would root some of the roots out to try to give you better.
Yeah, like goats and stuff. Goats. Yeah. So yeah, that's exactly right. If you can get this type of arrangement, and a lot of this stuff is just nobody's ever really thought about it. There are plenty of that have cats and goats and things like that. They'd be like, oh, really? Yeah, I can come and use your land and graze on state land. This is a really good possibility. They'll often even come in and put up the, in fact, in Puerto Rico, they came and put up the hot wires. We just went out there and told them, this is where we want you to do it, and we'll tell you when to take them off or to move them to the other compartment. And they were like, hell yeah, sure, we'll do it. And so you can make that type of arrangement. It just hasn't been done very often in the States. But it can be very, very effective way of manipulating the structure in moist soil wetlands. Okay, other questions? Yeah. Cattle pretty much eat any grass. Yeah, I'm sure they do have some preferences, but anything leafy they're eating. Well, see, in Puerto Rico, it was a problem. It was a big-time problem. I mean, we would disc, we'd set back succession. You couldn't even freaking walk through it, you know? And so we really had to be on top of it. You had to manage moist soil wetlands there 12 months out of the year. And so in general, probably not. I would think that for the most part, as you get later in succession, you know, into that third year, you may rotate some cattle in there because you start to get more robust plants, help them, have them open it up. And yeah, I guess it just probably depends on your area. The farther south you go, the more this is an issue. But it's even good, it's good landowner, you know, relations. You know, even if they're really, you don't really even need it, hey, if you can do that, I mean, that starts to get the word out, and the more you can interact with the surrounding community, the better. That's right, you bet. Okay, so use it to open dense vegetation. Yeah, and I mean, even if landowners themselves have what, which they do. One thing we haven't done is typically what you have is they may let them go down into a wetland and they just overgraze the hell out of it. That's generally my observations, at least in Tennessee. And so they're grazing way too much. And if we could, we really don't have the science to tell them how much to graze and how, unfortunately, we're kind of moving towards that direction right now with some of the work we're doing. So, I mean, you can't really blame them. But there are some really negative impacts that cattle can have when they get in and just completely overgraze the site, as y'all, I'm sure, are aware of. Okay. All right. Good. So they're not effective at setting back succession, but they can certainly influence the structure of the vegetation. Any questions? All right. So natural manipulations, here's some fires. That's a fire that we set at Rockefeller State Wildlife Refuge in Louisiana. No, that was the plan. Yeah, this actually, we just happened to be down there at the time. I was a grad student at the time, that's Dr. Rick Kaminsky right there. And we went down there, and they were ready. It was in November, and they were ready to do that winter burn. And they have to wait until they get a strong north wind, so it blows straight out to the coast. This Rockefeller State Wildlife Refuge is basically a coastal refuge, and it extends for about 10 to 15 miles inland. So they wait for a strong north wind, and then they set the fire, and it carries it all the way to the coast. And it is amazing because that, I never thought it was even possible. We were going out in airboats and setting the fire, okay? And they literally were just taking like pieces of paper and like throwing them over into the vegetation. It was kind of rank over top of water, and it was so dry, it just took off, and they would whip the airboat around and fan it, and it would just take off. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, it's mind-blowing, yeah. Yeah, so. At that time, for y'all that see internships and graduate positions or interested in grad school, behind him, the guy doing the little, you know, two fingers over Dr. Kaminsky's head, that is Dr. Mike Chamberlain at Louisiana State University. He's a good friend of mine. He studies carnivores and small mammals, and he's basically equivalent to Dr. Muller here, but he's down at LSU. All right. So, that was a pretty wild day. That was a fire. There's no doubt. And you could see it. We went after this. We went to another refuge 20 miles away, and we could see that huge plume. But they've been doing this for years upon years, and everybody in that area, not that there are a whole lot of people, it's coastal Louisiana, but they're all are aware of what they're doing. Other types of manipulations, again, herbicides. When do you use herbicides? Herbicides, in my opinion, first of all, they're used way too often. People go out there and they look and they see, okay, this is an undesirable plant. All right, let's pour chemicals on it. Let's try not to use herbicides. In general, what you can accomplish with herbicides, you can accomplish with water by overtopping that vegetation, going in and cutting it with a bush hog while it's alive, and then putting water over top of it by a couple feet and drowning the hell out of it. Holding it late, and then let the water out and do a late drawdown. Okay, so the process is bad plants. I've had a bad plant. You're looking, you're going in the fall. Look at this, whatever plant it may be, it's overtaking stuff. It could be an exotic like purple loosestrife or whatever. You can go in, and for the most part, you can either, if it's a wet, it's a very wet plant, you can dry it and kill it. Or if it's generally, if it's an emergent plant, you go in and the next year you cut it and you flood it deep and you hold the water on there and don't let anything grow. You then draw it down in August. You do a late drawdown. The soil heats up very quickly. The natural seeds that are there, your grasses and sedges, germinate and boom, they're up. Now you're also begin to germinate, but the thing is that now they're on an equal playing field. The one of the things that makes invasive species effective is they often get the head start. They often germinate at a lower temperature, or they're shooting up shoots vegetatively. They get over top and they outcompete your annual grasses and sedges. So most of the time you can do it with water by drowning the hell out of them or drying the hell out of them if they're aquatic species. Now, there are cases. One case is alligator weed, where if you flood it, it's okay. If you dry it out, it becomes emergent. If you cut it, you piss it off, and you just propagate it because it'll reproduce vegetatively, and it'll come back even stronger. If you bush hog, it really likes it. So any type of mechanical manipulation is not good. So you may need to use herbicides in certain cases. And so... here's a case here. This is Sesbania. This is your hemp or something? River hemp, yeah. River hemp, this is Sesbania. Sesbania is not a bad plant. This is a native plant, but it can grow extremely dense. Like with an early drawdown, this guy can grow faster and get over top of your annual grasses and sedges, which you can see out here, and it can shade out. It can shade out your annual grasses. Now, one of the things you can do, again, is you can come over that and you can cut it with a bush hog and you can flood it and it'll kill it. But if you have little grasses growing too, you're going to kill it, kill them too. So one thing you can do, this is a broadleaf emergent, is like with Sesbania or Cocklebur, which is Xanthium, is you can use 2,4-D. Renovate is, I guess, a brand name, Renovate 3, and those take care of broadleaf emergence, okay? So you can come in here. Now, you don't want to wait to the end of the growing season. You want to do this in the middle of the growing, so you want to do this in, like, you know, June or something. You're getting a problem. You see there's cocklebur out there. You see there's Sesbania out there, and they're shading out your little grasses. You want to go out there, and you want to hit them because it won't kill with some 2,4-D and kill your broadleaf emergence. Vines as well. As you get later in succession, you can have vines that'll often, a lot of your broadleaf vines and stuff, Ipomoea, Morning Glory, that might actually be Ipomoea, but Morning Glory is one of them that has a nice big leaf. Can shade things out if it grows really, really dense. Now, other things that will kill everything, like Rodeo is non-selective, is a glyphosate herbicide. So, you know, this is, you know, a situation where things are getting out of hand and you're trying to kill everything. You're like, Jesus, if I don't get a hold of this, you know, I'm this is it, you know. So you're going and you're dropping Rodeo on there, killing everything. Problems with Rodeo, there's been research that's just been published out of University of Pittsburgh. Rodeo has negative consequences on amphibians, big time. Okay, and it can kill the eggs. It can have negative impacts on larvae developing, and so this is one of the things. If you're going to use herbicides, you might be influencing organisms out there. And Rodeo has been shown to be bad in recent research. Now, I guess one of the I am actually not an expert when it comes to herbicides, and these recommendations I'm giving you are directly from biologists in the field. And they claim that using an arsenal herbicide, Habitat is one of the brands, is probably the best thing you can do, the most toxic thing you can do if you're really dealing with bad invasive exotics, is to use arsenal. And what you might expect is the cost of application goes up as you go from basically just focusing on broadleaf to a non-selective to something like Habitat, which is pulverizing stuff pretty bad. In fact, depending on who you work for, I think TWRA can use all of these. I don't think Fish and Wildlife Service can use arsenal. I'm not quite sure. Federal lands, it's more restricted. Does anybody know that? I think that is the case. Yeah, Drew, there you are. Another form, yeah. Yeah. So. All right. Now, other manipulations, agriculture. So we're going to move into that other triangle here. There are agricultural varieties of these hydrophytes, in particular Echinochloa, which is our barnyard grass, Echinochloa cruciale. There are a variety of agricultural varieties. One of those is an exotic Japanese millet. There's a brown top millet as well. But, the agricultural varieties of these millets, they produce more seed often, not always. I mean, if you do really good moist soil management, you have good fertile soils and a good drawdown, and you're early in success, our cruciale can produce pretty much as much as Japanese millet will or the brown top millet. But in general, the agricultural varieties have higher seed. But you're having to go in here with an additional cost, and you're having to go in and actually sow this plant. Now, what I recommend that if you are going to do that, there's some cost for you. You seed, seeding rate is 40 kilograms per hectare. It costs about $150 per hectare to plant, just to give you some numbers. But you do it at the higher elevations of your impoundment. So where you have maybe one of these impoundments where you have maybe 5 1-foot contours that you're crossing, all right, and here's where the water's coming out, this is your low end and your high end, is you might consider, if you're going to do that, plant some agricultural stuff up at the high end of those impoundments. These are not as water tolerant as the native plants, like for example, our regular common barnyard grass. So you don't want to put your agricultural varieties down in that lower area. You want to keep them up in the higher area. All right. The other thing you may even put within a moist soil impoundment are crops themselves, and we'll talk about that. You might put some things like maybe a strip of corn up in this higher area, and we'll talk about why that might be a good idea. You can plant these. A good time to plant the agricultural varieties is mid-June. That's plenty of time for these plants to develop and seed out. And I guess that's it there, okay? Any questions? We're just talking about agricultural varieties of hydrophytes, and then we'll talk specifically about crops. Questions? All right. Are you guys feeling like you're getting some information that you might be able to use someday? Yeah, it is a lot of information. We'll try to, put it in context at the very end, bring everything together. All right. Now, agriculture management. Ignore green browse right now. That should be transitioning in later on. This is a little schematic that you might think about. Is you have irrigated moist soil zone. This is one thing you might think about. Instead of when you have five contours because of the way that it's designed, you might actually just think about, you know what, I'm just going to manage the bottom two contours. You know, I'm just going to do my 2-foot contours here. Okay? And you have basically agricultural moist soil, you have moist soil going on in this zone. And up here you may actually plant. The other thing you can do is just plant strips of different types of crops. Okay, and this scenario here shows the green being green browse, which we'll talk about. Green browse is, you know, those types of food plot strips are for geese. Again, they're flying cows. You want to provide things like usually what's used is winter wheat. You may have another strip here of corn, which is indicated in this red, and then corn or milo, and then like buckwheat or millet in the pink. Now let's just kind of talk about this. In general, the important thing, and this is where I think that moist soil management and agriculture can be used in conjunction with each other, but how you want to do it ideally is in close proximity. Again, up at these higher elevations, you may end up flooding all the way up into those areas so that the birds can, like some of your species, like for example, geese, they'll walk in on dry land and eat agricultural grains. But a lot of your waterfowl still prefer to have, your ducks prefer to have it shallowly flooded. So even if this is irrigated here, a lot of times you're going to flood up into this the standing crops that you've planted. This is a good example of having moist soil right adjacent. Here's moist soil management, and then they've up at the higher elevations here, they've put a row of corn. Now, what can this provide? You have nice moist soil management here. You have natural seeds, first of all. You have high invertebrate production. And you can flood up in here, and then why do we want to flood and have agricultural varieties? Well, the primary reason is because there's a hell of a lot of energy in an agricultural seed. Okay, there's more energy in agricultural seeds than there are even in our natural moist soil seeds, and the yield is very high. So there are some benefits to providing corn, but we'll talk about in a minute why we don't just want to plant corn, all right? And I'll show you some results from some studies. Okay, the other thing that this does is if you are in a hunting scenario deal, this provides areas for hunters to hide in these corn strips, and then you have this nice, again, this nice moist soil habitat out in front. Okay, so the bottom line is that birds can acquire high energy ag grains without flying long distances, and this is, again, the reason and the recommendation behind putting them up at those higher elevations of a moist soil unit, if you can get in there and plant, okay? A lot of times it may just be too wet, but if you can get in there and plant, do it at the higher elevations. Now, ultimately what that means is you're putting these high energy agricultural grains in close proximity to the natural wetlands, which are important. Invertebrates provide some protein. There's no protein in here, okay? Very little invertebrate production in flooded agricultural areas. And also you have the natural seeds, which contain also very essential nutrients that you do not get from agricultural seeds. This harvest probability thing is if you have your ag fields a long distance away, okay, completely separated from your natural wetlands, for the most part, the birds are not going to stay in the agricultural systems, all right? They physiologically can't do it, I'll show you that, but they also generally won't stay out in those systems. They'll come back to the natural wetlands at least to roost and also to, again, pick up aquatic inverts and stuff. So the farther they have to travel, the worse. You want to keep them close. Again, remember, we're trying to conserve energy during the winter. All right? And also, the more they fly around, if you're thinking strictly from even a refuge context, the greater chance they have of being harvested or dying or whatever. So there's a lot of things that the more they fly can affect their survival. That might be your goal, is to increase harvest probability and to get them in a crossfire. And that can be part of it. So, again, green browse, winter wheat is generally planted for geese, and that's another group of waterfowl that generally you think about when you're managing your area. At least have a couple fields where geese can come in and they'll eat that. The green browse. They'll also eat corn. They'll eat it right off the stalk, actually. I've seen them walk into cornfields like this. Ducks won't do that. They'll need some water to be able to fly in. Now, one thing you can do if you are on a refuge, and what's commonly done is if you go in here and you bush hog your corn, you will make it available to ducks. If you bush hog the corn just gets spread all over the ground. They'll land in a dry field. Again, they prefer water, but they'll land in a dry field and eat it. But they will not go into the standing corn. You can also just run a tractor over it without a bush hog and knock it down. That's another way, and ducks will get in there. They're a little more hesitant than geese because they're just probably related to the possibility of predation. You know, coyotes and foxes and stuff can sneak up and can take a duck, and goose is a little bit bigger. A lot of times those types of predators don't look at geese as being as a food source. Okay. All right. Good? Questions? All right. One other thing is if you do that, let me just back up for a second. If you bush hog or you knock corn down, you cannot hunt over it. Okay? Nor can there be a reasonable evidence that birds coming to that cut corn can be shot by hunters outside of that refuge area. So this can only be done in a refuge area, and it cannot be done where it is still providing a hunting experience. Okay? You have to be very careful about that. All right, but that is what a lot of areas do that don't have hunting, or where they do have hunting, they do it far enough away from the hunting zone where it's not an issue. Like how far at Tennessee National, Drew, from those hunt clubs do they do that? Probably a half mile or a mile. They do a lot of knocking down of corn at Tennessee National Wildlife Refuge in the upland areas, and just for dry land feeding, but they have to be very careful about hunting clubs near them so that they themselves aren't breaking the law. Okay. All right, other types of agriculture, you see this more as you get down into Mississippi, Arkansas, and Louisiana, are rice fields and hunting over rice fields, and so that's another way, and of course, again, these generally for waterfowl or for ducks, well, for waterfowl, they love it when it's flooded. You can hunt over flooded corn. There's nothing illegal about that. That's the interesting thing. You can go in and you can plant and hunt over it, but you can't bush hog or knock it down and hunt over it, okay? It has to do with the definitions of baiting. Ultimately, yep. And for some reason, standing corn is still considered you can hunt over it. You can't bush hog it. And it comes back to, quote unquote, what is called a bona fide agricultural practice. You can hunt over bona fide agricultural practices, but you can't go in, and that is not a bona fide agricultural practice, going in and bush hogging corn down. Okay? Now, you can hunt over a combine field. That's legal, all right? And often in these share crop agreements, what they will do is they're out here harvesting maybe beans or something, and they're leaving the corn for the state area or the federal area. And you can hunt and you flood it up, and yes, there's seed floating all around, soybean seed or whatever. That's fine, okay? You can't knock it down, all right? If you do knock it down, like for example, this was an area that I worked at when I was an undergrad. We would go in and we would cut these corn strips so that we would delineate hunting zones. They were actual hunting zones. Well, we'd have to pick up all of the we would just knock them down. Actually, we wouldn't bush up, pick up the corn ears afterwards. So, and it's illegal for you, technically, to take a piece of corn off and throw it out there in the water. That is baiting. So, anyways. It is baiting, yeah. It's unnatural. Even though that's not necessarily natural, but it's unnatural. Yep, and you're scattering all over. That's right. Yeah. Well, and it's not even falling off. I mean, when this is flooded, and if it's up, you know, deep enough. The birds are eating it right off the husk right there. I mean, they're eating it right off the plant, and they're getting up there and they're pulling it right off. It's pretty neat when you go into these areas and you'll see where they've just worked it right off the plant. So these can be okay. So common agricultural grains that are used or plants are again sorghum, grain sorghum, milo. Soybeans, brown top millet was one of those agricultural varieties I talked about. Common buckwheat is another one that actually produces a pretty good seed for waterfowl. That's the genus and species there, common buckwheat. It kind of grows more like a moist soil plant. And then, of course, you have your corn and your rice and things like that. All right. Any questions? The other important thing here is, again, flooding shallowly. Most hunters like to do this. Flood it at least 3 feet deep so I can start up my motor and head on down, you know, the middle of the field. You know, I don't want to walk through ankle deep water, although that may be the best. Now, I will tell you is that's how you want to do it. You want, because there's going to be food resources from what's out here. If this is a share crop area or a moist soil area, you bring that up nice and slow, there's going to be birds in there using that and eating those food resources. All right. Now, with a cornfield, for example, you do need to flood it deeper because the geese will be able to get in there pretty easily and actually eat the corn ears right off the stalk. But you need to flood it probably thigh deep for the ducks to get in there and actually be able to get the corn ears. Now they do have new corn that they're making. It's called, it's a hybrid corn. It's like a dwarf corn or something. It's short. It only grows this tall. And the ears grow just like a foot off the ground. They start off foot off the ground. So some management areas are using that dwarf corn for wildlife use. And that's awesome. So then you don't have to flood it that deep. Okay? Now, why not just do agriculture? This will be something that you, I guarantee you, are going to have to answer sometime in your life. If you're managing waterfowl, because the hunters will come in and tell you plant corn. Well, I'm going to tell you how to do your job. You don't know a damn thing. I don't care if you're from University of Tennessee and have a degree in wildlife biologist. Yeah, plant corn. That's all the damn ducks like. All right. Well, I'm going to show you that is not the case. All right. And it's not healthy to feed ducks corn all the time or other grains. All right. Now, there are a couple reasons why. This is the first reason that's not even related to the physiology of the bird. This has to do with the percent decomposition of seed over time. In other words, you have these areas, and if you flood these areas, what happens when you flood these areas? How quickly does the seed hang around? All right. Soybeans, corn, grain sorghum, this is after 3 months of flooding. Notice that I mean, 86% decomposition here for soybeans in 90 days. Corn is 50% decomposed in 90 days. Grain sorghum, 42%. Down here, your moist soil plants don't decompose. They're in the seed bank for years after years after years, all right? So they're there. I mean, they're not decomposing. That's one reason, is because the longevity of that grain out there relatively limited. In fact, I have a grad student right now that's looking into, this is a flooded scenario, which we know grain seed rapidly decomposes. Looking at a terrestrial scenario, an upland scenario, behind a combine, how long does that seed hang out there? And what we're finding out is that for basically corn, grain, sorghum, and soybeans, basically a month or 2 months and all the damn seed's gone. So as fast or a similar faster rate than even being flooded. It's pretty wild that it's either decomposing, germinating, or it's being predated by other things besides waterfowl. So grain doesn't stay around very long. That's the first thing, okay? Whether you flood it or it's just behind a combine, okay? It's going to decompose quickly. If it's in a dry environment, in an upland environment, it's going to germinate, and a lot of other things like rodents and blackbirds and things like that are going to be trying to eat it as well and will be eating it. I will say if you're going to use agriculture, you do not want to flood those areas, okay, until the damn birds are there. Okay, so wait till November and December before you start flooding those areas, because they are hot areas. They do provide some very good energy resources, but they will disappear very quickly. All right? So those are some other ones. Now, if you will notice that, like, for example, this agricultural variety of millet is a little bit better. So it is better with respect to decomposition of plant, for example, brown top millet, than some of these agricultural grains. And rice is pretty low too. Of course, that's domestic rice, it isn't wild rice. Okay, now, what else do I have on this slide? I don't even know. Egg seed, yeah, whatever. We just pretty much talked about it. Okay, right, okay. Moist soils decompose more slowly and retain their nutritional quality longer than agricultural grains. They're correlated. When a seed decomposes, it loses its nutritional quality. Okay? All right. Good? Some of you guys are writing. Okay. Now, here's some research that shows you what can happen. This is body mass of... Darn. Of female mallards, I believe. This is one of the first studies that Kaminsky did with Chuck Lesh in the 80s. And he was running into, again, 80s, agriculture management. That was it. You flood corn, that's the way it is, all right? That's the only thing you do. And based on Dr. Kaminsky's understanding of avian physiology, he was like, that is not a healthy thing to do. So he looked at these birds, and basically he looked at, this is a standardized way, so it's just the changes. But what he did is he had hen mallards, and he basically fed them a control diet, okay, which was representative of actually a duck chow. It had all the nutrients he ever wanted, okay? I mean, all they needed. It was just this good stuff. And then he had millet, okay, a natural seed. This is Econicloa crucigalli. He had rice, he had corn, and he had soybeans. And he basically started it about the time waterfowl are getting down to Mississippi. All right, so right in November, end of November, and he looked at it through basically this period of time here, end of February when they start taking off, right? Basically about 90 days or so. And he fed these birds these different treatments. All right, so let's look at these. Here's the control on the top, y'all, right there. Right there, okay. They look like they're maintaining their body weight. Let's look at millet. Okay, millet's here. It's pretty much right by the control. All right, here's rice a little bit lower. Here's corn a little bit lower. And here's soybean even lower. All right, the bottom line is they're losing body mass. These hens are losing body mass significantly. All right, in fact, he had several that died that were eating soybeans only. They cannot maintain their body mass. That is not a damn good thing, okay, to be losing body mass in the winter, okay? Now, the other thing to note is once right here this ended and he gave all the ones that survived, okay, he gave them back, everybody got the control stuff, okay? And immediately those birds respond and look at the body mass. And so the bottom line is, even if, this is a good illustration, that even if birds are nutritionally stressed during the winter, if they survive and they get to an area where there's good habitat that has a good amount of nutritional quality with respect to protein and carbohydrates, their body mass can respond. Their bodies are resilient and they can get back to their original body weight. However, this is a scary thing, and this is why we just do not provide agricultural grains, because you will kill birds. Okay, it's as simple as that. It comes down to the nutritional quality. There are things in agricultural grains that are not in natural foods. And there are things that actually inhibit the metabolism of some of those things. Like, for example, we know that soybeans high in protein, but it's what's going on here if it's high in protein, okay? The thing is it has called a trypsin inhibitor, which is probably inhibiting the metabolism of metabolizing that protein, using that protein. Here we go. Rice and millet are better than soybean and corn, and mallards metabolize less energy from soybean than all other grains. There is a trypsin inhibitor may decrease the usability of the protein. So there are things that are chemically within different grains that prevent metabolic use of the protein and energy resources in that grain by waterfowl and other organisms. That might be contributing to why we're seeing these decreases in body mass. Now, so this is a quote from Kaminsky and Lesh: waterfowl cannot maintain body weight on agricultural seeds alone. Simple as that. And that is a message that we really need to take to the hunters and other biologists that are quote unquote old school, that have been out there for a while, that think that that's all you need to provide. That's not the case. You need to provide more than that one triangle in the management complex. All right. Now, I will say that when you look with respect to metabolizable energy for some of these grains, they do have a lot of energy. They are high in carbohydrates. Okay? So some of the grains, like for example, this is the metabolizable energy in corn versus moist soil seeds, run anywhere from 2.5 grams per kilocalories per gram to up around 3 kilocalories per gram, and corn is a little bit higher. But by energy alone, there's something else. We don't really know what's going on here. There's something else that's resulting. They just can't have the energy. They do need, again, it's probably related to protein-related, and the need for that protein that's resulting in that decrease. Okay, let's see here. Any questions? So you guys feel pretty confident. You understand why we don't just give them a bunch of high carbohydrate agricultural grains. There's something in natural seed, whatever it might be, whether it's just more of it's metabolizable, or there's protein or other types of trace elements that are critical to basically maintaining organisms over time. So those natural foods are critical. Hunting agriculture. So again, you do flood these areas, or even in dry land scenarios, and they can provide some great hunting experiences, and they do provide food resources for the birds. One thing that is a challenge is breaking a lot of the old school mold of that is the only way that you should, the only type of food resource you should provide for waterfowl. That's probably some of the greatest challenges as a biologist, is to try to convince people that that's not the case. You should not just provide that, because a lot of birds do flock into those areas. It's like eating candy to them, okay? And it's not good to eat candy all the time. You need to have your meat and potatoes. And they get a lot of high energy resources there, but they need their vegetables and their meats. They need to get over, and they need to get in those moist soil areas. Moist soil areas, again, can have very high seed production as well. And so, again, a good balance of moist soil areas and egg fields are good, and also forest wetlands, deep flooded marshes, etc., all the things we talked about. All right? So, any questions? Yeah, those are decoys. Yeah. Yeah, that's actually my uncle in Michigan. These are giant Canada geese. They hunt those things from September through the end of January. There are, I think the current population in Michigan is 1.5 million. These are flying cows that are very brilliant. They do not migrate. They stay there in the snow. And basically, they do have to have open water areas to roost. They fly out into these cut cornfields in Michigan, and they feed right through the snow. These are the birds that basically Tennessee has introduced in a lot of the southern states, Mississippi, etc., to establish a resident goose population. And then everybody gets pissed off because then they're on the reservoirs and they go up into people's yards all over the place. They're a darn hard bird to hunt. They are the smartest darn Canada goose. Subspecies of Canada goose that I know, because they just stay in the same area, and they literally learn, but they're hardy animals. All right, Dr. Rick Kaminsky on the right there, Dr. Bobby Cox on the left. So you'll be meeting Dr. Kaminsky here in a couple weeks, and yeah, that's a few birds that's out, and I think South Dakota someplace, a lot of ducks there. They've got some pheasants. They've had a pretty good hunt. There's a Canada goose. And anyways, so I'll end on that picture. Now, what I do want to do with the remaining time is say, hey, let's put this in context. So if we had an area like 6 management units, how might we manipulate the hydrology? How might we do set up a rotation with respect to disking to keep succession in an early state. Okay? Is that good? Any questions? Sound pretty good? Feel comfortable? Getting good information, hopefully? I will just mention here we have some handouts. I'll just direct your attention. With respect to that whole energy stuff with agricultural grains, we're going to hit that a lot tomorrow when we talk about duck use days. And we'll talk about the difference in metabolizable energy, which ultimately is the amount of kilocalories per gram of food. And we'll talk about that. So there's, this one here is the abstract from the work that we did about autumn manipulations. On the back side of that, you will see information on herbicides. Again, this is stuff to put in your folder for some time to use in your professional life. It's already been 2 years almost. Recently, the Southeast put out a moist soil management guidelines, Fish and Wildlife Service did. This document is online. It's one of those supplemental resource things on our website. And so this is actually not too bad. Y'all pretty much got everything and more in our talk today. But it's not too bad. It's a good resource, so just so you know of it. On the back side of that, you have really the waterfowl management, ecology and management text that we use. It's kind of the Bible by Dr. Guy Baldessari and Dr. Eric Bullen wrote that book, and it's on its second edition. It is kind of pricey, $112, but if you're interested in waterfowl ecology and management, and they do cover nesting stuff too, so the breeding ground stuff. The next thing is just two publications on managing amphibians, just more again, FYI. This is a paper by Ray Semlich out of University of Missouri that was in the Journal of Wildlife Management, talks about managing amphibians. And then just recently published by PARC, Partners for Amphibians and Reptiles, Reptile Conservation. The Southeast just put this out, and if you can go to the website, again, our website, go down to Supplemental Resources, you'll see that highlighted, that link, and you can pick this up for $10. You also should buy it if you don't have a copy, and have it in your management toolbox, okay? And I guess that was all the handouts I had today. Whew! All right. So, let's take a 5-minute break. I could just use a break from talking for a second.